This episode is sponsored by Podcorn. Podcorn is a marketplace connecting podcasters to a variety of podcast sponsorship opportunities, such as interview segments, topical discussions, and more. We utilize Podcorn because it easily allows us to browse opportunities on the website and work with brands directly without any exclusivities. Access Podcorn to help support your podcast by signing up at podcorn.com/podcasters.
Hi, this is Austin Wintory, and this is the Game Maker's Notebook. Today, I had the absolute pleasure of chatting with an old friend and a true fixture of the game music composers community, Jack Wall. Jack is especially well known for his music in the Mass Effect franchise, but most recently has been contributing to all of the Call of Duty Black Ops games, including the most recent Cold War. As is often the case, our conversation covered a ton of ground, and was a total blast, and I hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
All right, Jack Wall in London.
So Austin Wintory in Los Angeles.
Yeah, this is, you know, the original premise of these was the always in person, like at GDC or at DICE. And
that's gone out the window.
It's not just gone, but ironically, in your case, lockdowns notwithstanding, you're basically down the road, and yet we are chatting with you in London. So how is your view from on high over there?
I just kind of got out of here. You know, Cindy and I got out of here to out of LA to just be out of the country for the election. I mean, there were literally people going down Sepulveda Boulevard and Humvees with long guns. So we just wanted to get out of there for a while. It was just getting weird. So
it's pretty surprising that LA had its share of Trump rallies.
It did. Yeah. The whole concept of red and blue state is silly to begin with. But, you know, there's people who across the spectrum, I think, everywhere. It's just a matter of, you know, it's just a weird American thing, I think. But it was a bizarre. It's been a bizarre time in America, I think, overall.
This is a year that to say it will be remembered is obviously glossing over quite a lot. I feel like there's going to be a lot of therapy financed on the back of various ways of dealing with this year. From every angle.
There's a lot of angles to hit, isn't there? It's just crazy. And I just, you know, I'm sure you heard, as everyone did, that, you know, I lost my agent just a couple of weeks ago. And it's really sad. Cheryl Tiano was just a monster in the industry. And
she was an
amazing agent and such a good friend of mine. And I'm very sad about that.
It was
so, 2020 can kiss my ass.
Yeah, no kidding. That was I'm happy to pay tribute to her here in that way, just because she never represented me. We chatted about that possibility long ago, and she was one of those people that I immediately thought I could see her being a really killer agent. And obviously, you know, 3/4 of my composer friends, she repped.
Yeah.
Jason and so many others.
Feel like we were her only client. That was her gift. In any negotiation, I think everyone felt like she was super professional, but also like there was a win-win vibe to it. Like she never went over the line. She never even approached the line, but she always did the best for her clients. And you know, but you know, all that being great, business wise and all that, you know, the stuff I'm going to miss the most is our friendship. You know, she, you know, I'm going to get a little emotional here.
It's all good, man.
Yeah. She was great. She was, you know, she would take your call. She would never rush off the phone. She would always wait for you to say goodbye. She would never say goodbye first. You know, just,
it's a rare quality in an agent, especially at an agency like Gorfain Schwartz, where, you know, I'm sure the phone never stops ringing 24 hours a day for every conceivable reason, from composer clients calling, needing attention, to people calling, trying to pay composers and everything in between. Exactly. Yeah, she was a real force in the business. I had no idea. I obviously she and I weren't that close. I did enjoy bonding with her about her amazing cats.
Her animals were everything. Yeah.
Yeah, she had these gorgeous, like little, not Savannah cats, but there's a similar breed that have a real striking kind of almost tiger like look. I'm blanking on the specific breed, but I was thinking of getting one of those like 10 years ago. And when I saw she had one, I reached out and was like, I need to know about your experience with these. And she loved them. I wish I knew her better. Cause I didn't know anybody that didn't speak of her the way you are right now. I mean, it's just and composers, especially in the sort of Hollywood branch, like the kind of LA tilted composers, it's such a cliche of people wanting to complain about their agent, but no one ever did about her.
Yeah. Not that I'm aware of. And, you know, it makes sense to me because of the way she, like, you know, just overhearing her, you know, with other people, you know, like Sarah Schachner or other people in her stable of composers, just, you know, they always seem to be doing well, and she was taking care of them as well, from what I could see, you know, the same as me. And I love that. And it didn't matter how far up the food chain you were, she treated everyone the same, as far as I could tell, you know.
Well, and I think that's a pretty big statement, because at an agency that reps like John Williams, people who are working in games could very easily be seen as kind of second-class citizens.
She definitely treated all of us with just a boatload of respect, and everybody felt good about it. So yeah, she will be missed greatly. And there's a memorial that is happening in a few hours that I'm going to attend, and hopefully get a chance to say a few words, because, you know, I'm just glad we all get together a little bit, even through Zoom or whatever it is, to do that.
Yeah, it's a strange reality that what is effectively a conference call becomes the way we, you know, commiserate and find ways to come together. I mean, I admire that as just kind of like a human resilience kind of thing of, you know, we're not gonna not honor our cherished friends and colleagues. So even if we have to do it on a fucking Zoom call, then we will do it. You know, there's something about that, right? I find very uplifting.
Well, it's important, especially now. I mean, you know, the first thing Cindy and I were talking about is, I said to her, I looked at her, I said, oh my God, I'm in London. We're going to be here for a long time. How am I going to, do I go home for the funeral? And she looks at me and says, Jack, there's no funerals now. I'm like, oh, you're right. So this is what it is. So at least we get to do this, which is great.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I appreciate, in the context of all that, you setting aside some time to talk some games, talk some music. You know, life always,
absolutely,
life and work. And there's always that discussion of the work-life balance. And for me, I've always seen it as kind of deliberately messy, because when you care about your work, at least speaking, if only for myself,
all these things get blurred together. And so any, but even despite that, I'm glad that you, that we made a chance to do this, because I've been eager to chat with you here basically since we started doing this. I tell your story a lot.
Which one is that?
Well, yeah, all the ones that would get us thrown in jail. No, I love particularly, you know, I get a lot of composers reaching out to me who are, you know, just graduating from school or you know, pivoting into music from some other career and deciding to pursue the dream. And you know, people just reaching out or leaving comments on Twitter or wherever saying, you know, how do I do this? Where do I even start? You know, it's such a big monster to try to grab by the horns. And a story, I love bringing you up. I literally do probably 9 out of 10 times. Especially if I'm in a real conversation with someone about that, about career trajectories and arc, you're someone, because you are a real anomaly, if I may say it, in this business, because you've been around a lot longer than most other folks, and you have found ways to reinvent yourself, and you've also stayed, you know, at the leading edge. I mean, the fact that mere days ago, a massive new Call of Duty, and it's like your 40th one scoring, came out.
Divide by 10 and you're spot on. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's more than one or two. You've really come to dominate the sound of that franchise. And obviously, particularly speaking, the Black Ops kind of neighborhood within there. But you know, it's a tough business to sort of, to put it bluntly, to stay relevant in. There's a lot of folks that, you know, it's true of any creative field. I mean, look at actors or look at filmmakers, or, you know, it's sometimes people are given their shot. They have a great little flourish of creativity. And then somehow things seem to drift away. And I've always admired that you've found ways to really remain a voice that people are interested in and care about. And the reason I bring you up specifically is because it's my favorite story ever that I'm going to humbly ask that you restate for us here is your connection to Mr. Tui.
Yes.
Began the most fabulous way. And it's a perfect lesson in you never know what will happen, and you never know, more crucially, how long a relationship needs to kind of manifest into something else. And I just think it's such a powerful lesson for people, especially those that are feeling very stir crazy and feeling very impatient and restless of, you know, how do I want to get going. I want to have had my big break yesterday. And it's like, just recognize you can't control time. So anyway, you know the story I'm aimed at here, if you would.
Yeah, I do. Mr. Tui being Brian Tui, audio director currently at Treyarch and has been for some time. Brian Tui and I worked together. I think the first time we worked together on Call of Duty was Black Ops 2, and that was in 2011-12 timeframe. That was my first Call of Duty. Now, 10 or 12 years before that, I was working with him at a small, much smaller developer as a you know, freelance composer, but earlier in my career, with him at a place called Gigawatt Studios, very small shop that did a bunch of stuff with Mattel and other licensors, and we did Disney and stuff like that. So I did a bunch of games with them. And one of the games that Brian and I talk about, like, we went from it's sort of zero to hero kind of thing. We went from something called Secret Agent Barbie. Sorry, something like that. Yeah. Why can't I remember the name of it?
I always just say it's a Barbie game.
Barbie Secret Agent. That was the name of the game. And, you know, Barbie is this, you know, international Barbie's James Bond character who's running around solving crimes and, you know, international crimes. And it was my daughter's like favorite game when she was four, you know, she's 23 now. So it was inauspicious beginnings. Right. And then in 2010 or 11, Brian at Treyarch they were looking for a new composer for the series, and they were playing through Mass Effect 2 at the time, which had come out in 2010, and they all loved that game. And they like, Brian looked and saw who did the score for that. Let's get them. And it was me. And he called me and he's like, dude, I had no idea. Cause we hadn't really been in touch for all that time at all. And he just called me up and said, hey, are you interested in, you know, Call of Duty? I'm like, yes, a little bit. And, you know, it's one of the great, it truly is one of the great relationships of my career. I mean, you know, careers are made and broken over relationships, right? Exactly. I was, and I've experienced it all. I was not invited back on the Mass Effect series for the third installment, and that was heartbreaking. But at the same time, somewhat of a relief because it was a tough working relationship. But I love that game. You know, it's such an important game.
Yeah, I want to talk about those as well, just because it's just one of those seminal. It's a seminal work, and it's also personally, it's just one of my absolute favorite franchises of all time.
Yeah, and looking back, saying, "Oh, it was a tough relationship." You know, those games were tough to make because, you know, lines were being crossed, things were being done that hadn't been done before, and it came out great in the end, you know. So it's just hard work, really, at the end of the day.
Clearly.
It generated something that's truly memorable, and they're coming out with a remaster of the whole first three. You know, it's great. It's just wonderful. I can't believe, like, what game has that kind of staying power? Very few, right? Final Fantasy does that. You know, there's very few games. Halo does that. Mass Effect does that. And that's such an honor to be part of it. You know, so very cool. But then, you know, Brian and I have been working together now. We just finished our fourth game and we're already talking about the next one. You know, it's like our relationship is really solid. And it's just, I'm so grateful for that relationship because that really truly is the longevity that I experience. You know, it's that sort of thing, you know?
Well, and it's just I mean, you said it perfectly. Every career is your body of work, of course, matters, but you know, the fact that he was like, oh, Mass Effect's pretty cool, let's look that, and then your name, you know, you're not the only composer involved in Mass Effect, but seeing your name, you would have stood out instantly just because it was like, hey, I know that guy, I like that guy,
and we had a history. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had a great relationship at Gigawatt. It was, you know, everybody there went off and did great things. And that was no different. You know, Brian being the audio director of one of the biggest, you know, they have 300 employees, you know, it's been around forever and they will continue to be. They're always doing great work and always complaining about it could be better, but that's just because they're passionate about it and they just want to make it better all the time. And I think this is one of their best games ever, actually, Cold War. I was
hell-bent on playing it in anticipation of this call, and my internet was kind of slugging along, and it's like 1,000 gig download. So I wasn't able to play it before. I was able to listen to the score, which is, you know, it's very you. In fact, there's some stuff with the kind of analog synth vibes that actually gave me these wonderful Mass Effect flashbacks but fused with this kind of Russian, you know, comrade wall was like a, you know, the whole thing was delicious. But I'll report back when I have a chance to play it. I've always enjoyed that. The single player campaigns of Call of Duty, just broadly, like whether we're talking Modern Warfare, Black Ops, that's one of those uniquely satisfying. They always seem to be magically the exact right length for what I'm looking for. You know,
this one's actually short too. This is a fairly short campaign. Probably not the least reason is that you know, I think Sledgehammer, I think everybody knows this. Sledgehammer was originally slated to put this one out, and then something just sort of fell apart at that company, and they and so Treyarch was, you know, asked to stand up and make it happen a year sooner than they would have. So they did a pretty phenomenal job, and so did Raven Software also. They came in and really masterminded kind of the whole single player campaign, which is no, you know, that's no small ask. And they did, I thought they did a really great job with it. I thought the story was really cohesive and it was really a joy to score. And it was like, usually my Black Ops scores are kind of all over the place. You know, they're so varied because basically gameplay takes you all over the world. And, you know, I like to sort of score the location as well as characters and stuff like that. And, you know, but it's harder when you do that to sort of recur themes and make that more memorable. And in this case, it was all very contained. So it was all about one story that happened during the Cold War. So I was able to keep my themes really, you know, I only had two or three of them, but they keep recurring. So it's satisfying, I think, to listen to it and hear that. And this, you know, as a composer creatively, that's a really cool thing. It's very film score-y to do.
Oh yeah, we love that. I think in general, the just sort of broad umbrella of Black Ops has given you quite the playground between this and the, you know, the all the kind of zombie like side quest, as it were, mission of scoring that and that's taking you with all the big band. And I want to get into all that, but I just to put a button on the relationship thing, it to me, it's just, it really is such a magnificent story that this was like, what you like 98, 99, something like that, that you guys were doing that. You said,
what's Barbie Secret Agent.
Yeah.
It's more like 2000, somewhere in there. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Point being, there's just not a lot of, and I love that. I mean, that's solidly 20 years ago, and there's, you know, it's, this industry, I find games as an industry is pretty fascinating because right around 2000 was when the whole thing kind of started to mutate into the industry as we identify it today. And like composers started to become freelance as a more normal thing. Whereas prior to that in the 80s and 90s, it was pretty much strictly in-house composers, and it was no longer like you could actually write music as a traditional composer, even if there's not a recording budget. It's just you could produce music in a way that's familiar to all other composers, as opposed to having to be effectively a programmer who's forcing the hardware to play back music for you in the way the earlier generations of composers were. And so the point being that there are very few composers who kind of survived over the hump of that transition. Like there's a lot of luminary figures from the 80s and 90s. And then there's, you know, people that emerge in the wake of that, but there's very few people that seem to straddle both. And you definitely are of the, you were kind of right at the front end of that, of the kind of rebirth of the industry. You know, Peter McConnell.
When you say front end, you're absolutely right. It was the right at the beginning, because if you think about the technology, you know, meeting the challenge, right? Because that's what you needed. You need technology to get to a point on a computer where you could actually play full res music, right? So the CD-ROM was released for the very first time in 1993. And it came standard with every PC that you bought back then. And that was still early days of PCs, really. But that's when the mass market really started. That's when the game Myst came out and all these, that's why Myst was so successful, because it was OEM with every single computer purchase, right? So, and it was the killer app. So you had the ability, because you're talking about a floppy disk with what, 5 megabytes on it? And then you go from that to a CD-ROM with 700 megabytes on it. So it's like night and day technology-wise. So I started writing at the end of – my first game was at the end of 95 when all that was very new.
And what led you to that? Let's just get a little background bio on the record here.
Oh, well, you probably know the story because we've talked about it. Probably
for the benefit of our fair listeners.
Yeah, I just didn't want to bore you again. But
Not at all, man. No,
sure.
I love it.
I was a recording engineer in the late 80s and early 90s, working in Manhattan in the music business. And sometime around 94, I was working with this band on Capitol Records called 2.5D. They were kind of an avant-garde rock band centered around the lead singer, who was a software designer, and she had created this new software that Capitol Records was interested in called Relationship on a Disk, or the acronym was called RODE. And basically you could interact with your favorite artists in an interactive way on a CD-ROM. So what her idea was is, you know, let's do, you know, everyone was trying to figure out what to do. They called it new media back then, right? Like,
yeah.
how can we have a She was using like Jungian archetypes to, you know, sort of do conversation trees, right? So, you know, if you asked Mick Jagger, you know, a certain question and he would answer it a certain way, and then you would answer, you know, you would ask another question, then you would over time create this through this dialogue tree, you would create this relationship with your favorite artist kind of. And so that was her invention. And
pretty ahead of its time, to be honest.
She was always ahead of her time. Like that. I mean, she was in Wired magazine and, you know, with Peter Gabriel, and she was talking to him and she was doing all this crazy stuff. And this girl is Cindy Shapiro, who, you know, full disclosure, she's my wife. So Cindy was really kind of at the forefront of technology and music, right? So Gary Gersh, who was the head of Capitol Records, signed her to a development deal. And I was actually working on those recordings with them. And, over time, you know, we just became kind of close friends. I took her out for a dress. I really want to pick your brain about this game thing, you know, and all the bandmates were kind of like in the background going, oh, I think Jack's going in. I think he's going to ask her out and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, I was really just thinking, you know, I just want to pick her brain, you know? So I did, I took her out, you know, like 6 hours into that meeting, I realized I was on a date, you know, it was that kind of a deal. So,
she also realized the same thing.
We just really got on really well. So, and we still do to this day. So, she was a software designer during the day, working for Channel 13 at the flagship PBS station in Manhattan, in New York. And, so, you know, she was working on games basically, for lack of a better way to put it. They were educational games, but they were games for kids, for computers and all that stuff. So I just got into her head about it. And then she introduced me to Myst. And then before long, she, you know, through our relationship, she said one of her best friends started a game company. And this guy asked us to do the music for that game. So that's how I started. And that was back in 95.
And you were always freelance, right? Like before.
Yeah, I've never worked for anyone in my life. I worked because I have a degree in civil engineering. So I worked, you know, I got into this whole business kind of late. I was 31, I think, when I started writing that game. But yeah, I had a whole career as a recording engineer, mixer kind of guy. And before that, I was a civil engineer. So I worked for one civil engineering firm in New Jersey out for about a year. And then I just became a bartender because I didn't want to do that. And then eventually I got into the music business.
I didn't actually remember the civil engineering or the bartender bit. That's fantastic.
Yeah. I have some great stories about that. I had no idea how to bartend. I'd been a waiter through college, put myself through college. And, you know, I remember I had an audition, believe it or not, to be a bartender at this really hot, you know, restaurant in Philadelphia. And
I'm picturing Coyote.
We had this beautiful big house, me and a roommate in New Jersey. And I was making this transition pretty fast. So we invited all of our friends over and told them what bottle of liquor to bring. And I put a big blackboard up behind the bar that I created. And I told them that, you know, they once I made them a drink, I would cross that off, and they could only order from the drinks that were on the menu. And then it was like 100 drinks on the menu. So I had to make all those drinks. That's how I learned how to be a bartender overnight. And then I went in the next day, and the bar manager was like, yeah, this guy said to the other bartender, like, yeah, this guy really seems to know what he's doing. It's kind of hilarious because I sure didn't, but, you know.
That's so funny. I now there's two reasons why I'm going to end up talking about you to folks all the time, because there's a story I love to tell where one time this girl came over to my studio looking for career advice, and she was, you know, composer trying to figure out how to make inroads, and so we just got to talking about, you know, all kinds of career and that sort of thing. And then at one point it was really clear that she was not earning a living at all from music. And I said, you know, do you mind I asking, how do you pay your bills? And she looked very shy and sheepish and said, well, you know, I actually bartend, and as if there's some shame in that. And I was like, why are you acting like you are embarrassed to tell me that? She's like, well, you know, it's not music, and that's what I'm supposed to be doing. And a lot of that. I said, but bartending, I said, first off, any job can teach us whatever we want to learn from it, to be honest, if you go looking for the lessons. But bartending in particular, I said, you're literally creating things for people. I said that it is a creative job.
That was one of the best jobs I ever had in my life.
I believe it.
Yeah, because for the simple reason that I loved meeting new people. I loved getting new ideas. I became friends with, through this job, I became friends with like the mayor of Philadelphia, Ed Rendell at the time, like not friends, but I mean, you know, acquaintances. I was friends literally with this investment banker who worked down the street, 'cause he was a regular customer. He would invite me over and we'd have coffee and just talk about life, you know? And I just got to meet all these great people. And, it was just a phenomenal job, really.
That's funny.
Fantastic. It gave me the impetus to move on, actually. It actually gave me like ideas. Because I remember going to see this banker and saying, I don't know what to do with my life. I'm 25 and I have no freaking idea what I'm going to do. And he's, you know, I expected, you know, by now or maybe by 30, I'll really know what I want. And he just looked at me and he goes, maybe not. You know, he's this really easygoing guy. He goes, yeah, just give it a shot. You know, maybe not. Maybe you won't know. Who cares? Whatever. It's the adventure. It's the journey. It's the, you know, the whole thing. He was very zen about the whole thing. And I was just like, oh my God, that actually changed my whole perspective so much. And you never know when someone is going to do that to you. They're going to change your whole mind, your perception, your perspective. And then suddenly you've got like a direction you can go. You may not know exactly where you're going, but at least, oh, I'm directed now. I feel like I can head down this new path. And, you know, and so I followed that dream literally because he said that. I said, I'm going to move to Boston and learn how to be, I'm going to go to Berklee College of Music, and I'm going to learn how to be I'm going to learn how to do music in the studio. That's what I'm going to do. And of course I went there and didn't do that. I found a new way, but it gave me a direction, you know.
Were you playing music on the side of all this? Or
hell yeah. Yeah. I was always playing music. I was always in a band. I loved music. Always had a band. Always was trying to write songs, trying to do stuff like that. But I never had the aspiration to be like a film composer. That wasn't even on my radar back then, you know. I was just more into the music side of things.
So, you know, so what songs, were you really. Like guitarist or what were you, what was your
I was
kind
a guitarist,
of,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, I see. Got it.
Everybody was a guitarist, weren't they? I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, you could have said bass.
I was one of many.
I was giving you a little bit of a landing zone there. Yeah. Well, yeah, that makes sense then. And so then you started engineering. What set your eyes on – because you compose – like there's a few different types of composers. There's, you know, the folks that they see writing music through the lens of having played in a band. And right. It's to them it's very much coming from that – performance instinct, you know, it's coming from the angle of like I feel music through my fingers or through my hands, that kind of thing. And then there's the more classical, the composers who are coming from, you know, they think in terms of like staff paper and treble clefs and that kind of thing. And it, to them, it's a written exercise. You know, it sounds like for you, you're as an engineer and as a performer, you were coming at it from that angle. But that's, it sounds to me, but what's striking about that is you wouldn't guess that listening to your orchestral writing, because you really know what you're doing and really write earnestly in that way. So how did you make that? I didn't know that. Well, that's why it came as a surprise to me when I learned your background. Whenever I learned that, it came as a surprise because I had always assumed you were one of those more bookish composers, we can say, where you were coming from more like growing up. You know, if you have a choice between like my hero is going to be Jimi Hendrix or John Williams, you know, I would have absolutely assumed you were a John Williams type.
And no, not at all. Like, I didn't even know. I loved Star Wars, but I didn't even think about the music, honestly. I really didn't.
Yeah.
Like, I know so many composers who are like, oh my God, I grew up listening to John Williams. I want to become a composer. Yeah, that was not my path. I sometimes look back on that time, like my early, my childhood and my grown up years, like, what did I like back then? I was just into music. I loved listening to, you know, the radio. I mean, that shows how old I am. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of weird that I ended up doing this, but like, you know, it's just one of those crazy meandering paths that led me to it. And then I realized how much I loved it. And you know, that all the bookish stuff, I have studied privately with people, orchestration and counterpoint and harmony, all the composition, like those things I've lightly studied as a individual one-on-one with other people, and conducting and all those skills that you learn in college, I kind of did it on my own. But you know, I'm literally at this moment, I've got time off. COVID has hit. Nobody's banging my door down for new work right now. So I'm thinking I could just take some time and maybe go back to studying a little bit and try to get a new perspective on music. Yeah, because you know, I've been doing this a long time and I get bored with my process, you know, I kind of want to shake it up. Like I like the idea of maybe what I'll do is I'll put my computer away and I'll just have my piano and a piece of paper and a pencil and I'll learn to do it that way. I know it's hard to do that if you haven't done that. But I have tried to do that in the past, but I'd like to see what happens when I do that and see if I can just break out of my sort of habits, you know? There's a number of people I'd love to study with, like Bruce Broughton or, you know, Neil, oh my God, he's a good friend of mine. I can't remember his last name right now.
He's Neil Desby? Me.
Thank you. Neil Desby. He's kind of a genius.
He is, yeah.
People like that, you know, just maybe study with them and just see what happens, you know?
Yeah. When Doom came out in 2016, Mick Gordon gave a TED talk, a GDC talk, about his process. And that was kind of his mantra throughout that talk was, if you want to yield new results, change your process. And how he said he approached that score differently than he had approached prior works to intentionally force himself somewhere he hadn't been.
And I love his work. I really do.
Oh yeah. That was one of the most jaw dropping GDC talk. I think everyone will remember that as just like anybody who was in that room,
unfortunately, but yeah,
he was a force to be reckoned with that day. It was pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. He's a unique cat. He's just such a gifted producer as well. Like, I don't know.
No kidding.
His stuff sounds great. As does yours, my friend.
Well, you're very kind. You? It's all. I actually had the great pleasure of reversing the tides on here. I guess it was during E3.
Somebody else interviewed you. Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, Robin Hunneke, who was the producer on Journey, and she's also kind of the nice. The recurring guest host of this podcast, interviewing mostly developers. But because she and I had the working history, we've done two games together. It was like, why don't you guys chat? And the funny thing is that it was probably an emotionally exhausting thing to listen to because she and I have this very kind of raw, unfiltered relationship. And it always, every conversation, we skip right past how's the weather and go straight to like, you know, how's that existential crisis treating you? And we go just, and so it was, I don't actually remember, I only remember that our conversation got really sort of vulnerable and intense. But it was so us that I thought, oh, yeah. Well, I wouldn't change anything about that then.
You know, I think this is going well. I mean, you know, so far we've laughed, we've cried. So
yeah, yeah, man. Well, you're the real deal. That's the thing. That's why you're, I was just so genuinely looking forward to this. And so to that then, the thing I don't know that I have ever asked you and I don't know the answer to is how you really then, yeah, I mean, I get that you were kind of learning on the side and just learning by doing, you know, there's something to be said about taking on a job where you know you're going to have to do something that on the day you sign the contract, you don't actually know that you don't really know how to do it.
Right.
And like, you're just trusting that you can figure it out. And I think that there's something to be said for just embracing your own potential more than the confidence of like, yeah, of course I know how to do that. And, but where did you, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, I think if you hear anyone who's like ultimately successful in what they're doing in the arts, you know, the arts are intentionally, they're just, you know, they're visceral, you know, there's nothing to really grab onto except, you know, your inner belief that you can do something, right? So when somebody asks you to do something and you don't know how to do it, what do you say? You say, yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Right. I will do that.
Exactly.
And you just figure it out. That's the bottom line. You just have to do that. And it yields just to put that kind of pressure. If you're not riddled with anxiety, you know, to the point where it's detrimental to your mental health, like I think that, you know, and that's something that can be overcome, of course, but I think that you just need to have faith in yourself. I think it's really important to just say, yes, I can do this and then figure it out. And I just, you know, I've done that so many times in my life. I've done that so many times in my life that, you know, I have ultimate faith that I could do just about anything at this point. And I push myself to do things I haven't done for that reason, because then, you know, if I'm just writing the same music I've always written, you know, that's where all the big band stuff came from. I have a love of big band music. It comes from my childhood. My dad played it all the time. So I had that in my head. I just had no idea how to do it. And then I just learned how to do it real fast and it came out great, you know? And of course I hired people to help me get the arrangement right, because I'm not a jazz arranger and I don't pretend to be, but, you know, I think the results are, you know, I'm really proud of that. You know, it was just something somebody said, hey, who's going to do this jazz thing we need? And Brian Toohey said, well, Jack's going to do it. Like he had faith in me. So why shouldn't I? Right. And I did it.
His ignorance served you well. That's so hilarious. Yeah. And so we're talking about on Black Ops 2.
And three and four. We did jazz on all that stuff.
Initial time, that first time.
Yeah. The first time. Yeah.
It wasn't that for the zombie mode, like the zombie.
Yeah. All of it was for zombies. Yeah. It was Shadows of Evil, which is the first time they had put zombies on the disc at launch. Usually it was DLC before that, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, and then another great part of that story, we're just kind of zooming all over the place here, but I love it. I always love your snakeskin boots, like the songwriting that went into that, which was also a chance for you, you know, like, you know, for the way that you talked about Cindy in the beginning of this conversation as someone who's coming from, you know, software, where software and the arts meet and kind of innovative ways of merging these otherwise unrelated disciplines, and obviously discovering, hey, we're on a date and you've had a family together, all of that stuff. We're kind of, we're glossing over the fact that she's also a musician, and composer and musical mind in her own right. And that gave you guys a chance to collaborate, which I think was that not the first time you had been able to collaborate, like bring her into what you're doing?
Oh, I mean, she's a singer too. So I've hired her, countless times to sing. But I think that was the first, maybe the first time we wrote together. I don't know. It's been a long road with her. We've been down that we just celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary. So, you know, we're pretty happy about all that. But yeah, it's, you know, it's funny. Like they asked me to do this and I'm like, you know, and it had to be songs and the songs had to have meaning. And I thought, well, I could write the lyrics, you know, I can write lyrics, but if you want good lyrics, it shouldn't be me, you know? And Cindy is genius at lyrics. So I love her. Like I would never work with anyone else in terms of lyrics. I just love the way she writes lyrics and how thoughtful she is. And she allows me to kind of kick in my ideas too. But it's like, I'd be a good background singer. I wouldn't be a good lead singer. It's kind of like that, right? Like I can contribute something really cool to this, but I don't want to be the lead on it. So, between the two of us, you know, we got the lyrics, I think, pretty cool. And, you know, I think it's one of my top most streamed songs on, Spotify, but, the Mass Effect always kills it, but it's pretty close.
yeah, I think it is actually, cause I pulled up in order to listen to Cold War, I pulled up your, you know, page on Spotify that just compiles everything together. And Snakeskin Boots was, I think it was number one or number two. And I just love that. It's like, who would guess that, you know, the runaway hit from Call of Duty, you know, Call of Duty Black Ops, like you instantly start thinking, like you go straight to this headspace of orchestra and grungy synths and all the, you know, loud drums. Oh, absolutely. And you obviously recorded a bunch of that in London, you know, with the top players on the planet, and that it's all done, all the bells and whistles. And yet this sort of swing tune, this kind of scorching big band song is the thing that rises up. I just love the randomness of that.
Genesis of this was, it's so funny how like a composer can sort of help drive, you know, what actually happens. And it's so much kudos to Treyarch. They always give me freedom. You know, they just let me run with this stuff. They don't hold me back ever. So what they said was, okay, we need a big band tune. This is the only thing they asked for. They said, we need a big band tune that is sort of a torch song because the main character, the girl, is going to be singing in a nightclub. And so we need a song for her. And I was like, oh, cool. And it's like jazz and big band and stuff. I said, cool. I'd love to do that. But I said, listen, I got the musicians for 3 hours. I can record a song like that in maybe 20 minutes. So why don't I write like an up-tempo kind of swing tune as well? Because I think you guys are going to want that, you know? And thank
such
God.
Such a drug dealer.
That.
Yeah. I love
it. Like, so I was just like, yeah, I think you're going to want that, you know? And they were like, oh, can you do that? Do we have the budget for that? I'm like, listen, I'll make it work. Don't worry about it, you know? So, so we were able to fit that in. And then there was all these kind of fun little, you know, jingles for the Perca-Cola sodas that they had. So, you know, we had so much fun doing that. It was so fun to write these funny lyrics and these little stupid little jingles that, you know, everybody loves. And so we did that. And then, but then Snakeskin Boots was born out of that. And then they ended up using that to launch the whole zombie mode. Cause that was just
it was like a trailer.
Yeah. Yeah, they just cut it into the trailer. It's so cool.
I remember it well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that's, you know, another thing about that, that is just another one of those wonderful lessons, is that you never know where, like, if you approach this career openly, it can take you places that you would never plot on your own. Like, you didn't sit down and say, okay, 5-year career goal, I really want to write some swing music for Call of Duty.
No, like, further thing for my mom. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's not a sentence anyone ever said before. That is, like, in the history of humanity, I doubt that was a phrase that existed. And so I love the kind of chaos of that. It's just fantastic. And it turned out amazingly. I mean, that's one of the things that I've admired in your writing in general, is that as much as you clearly have a producer's ear, you know, for really crafting the sound, there's always been space for the musicians to really be musicians, because big band demands that, you know, as much as the notion of being like a top phenomenal jazz producer is a viable thing. Mm-hmm. Big band is nothing if jazz in general, but big band in particular, is nothing if you're not really hearing the performers, if you're not writing it in a way that really lets them speak, because that it's a performer's art. That's really, it's just one of those idioms of music where it's like speed metal, where, you know, like that, you have to hear them play because that is the sound. That's what it is.
Right.
And I've always admired that, even in your, you know, thickest, most sort of gnarly, badass stuff, there always seems to be an awareness of the performer, which is, I find that rare. That type of music, the big, really like blockbuster kind of stuff, it's so much about the wall of sound, not to be a pun about it. I'm sure you've dealt with that for a while. Like, as much as that's the temptation, you know, to make it somehow a thing where the performers still come through is rare, and it's difficult. It always seems like,
yeah, well, I really appreciate you saying that, because that's something that only another composer could understand. And I really, really do appreciate that.
It's a tough line to walk, you know?
But I think it's also like a product of my being a mix engineer for so many years before I was a composer. Like, just listening to, like, I remember when I was learning how to be a mix engineer at a place called Platinum Island Studios, no longer exists in Manhattan. The B-52's slave reel for Love Shack was in the vaults at that studio, and late at night, you know, I'm talking 2-3 in the morning, I would just pull that out because no one else was around, and I would just put that up and listen to everything, you know, listen to each track and how unbelievably pristine every single element of that recording was. I mean, from the drums to the bass to the keyboards to the vocals, I mean, it was just so beautifully produced. And I just remember, like, you know, that was me spending the time really listening to the elements of what makes a great mix, right? And every element has to be great in order to be a great result in the end, right? And it has to give, every single element has to give the other elements room to breathe, right? So there's all this very complex musical chess that you have to play to make that mix really all it can be. And it's not something I always achieve. I'm just saying it's something to strive for, because it is an art form that is inexact. There are a million answers to the same question. No, there is no right and wrong, but, you know, at the end of the day, every element has to sound great. And it's like, you know, I have an assistant. I've always had assistants for the last, I don't know, 12 years or so. And one of the things I love to do is to teach them to write music for media, and how to tell the story, and how to mix, and how to do all the different things you have to be able to do. And one of the things that, you know, my current assistant, Jim, has been with me for 6 years now. And I always give him tracks to write, not just for, you know, exercise, but, you know, that will end up in the actual game or television show or whatever, because I want them to have that experience of understanding and hearing their stuff back from the product, you know, to give them that satisfaction. I figure, you know, they don't make a lot of money, assistants. So it's really important for me to make sure that they get something out of it. So, you know, one of the things I love teaching is mixing, because it's just like, okay, you hear this track, you hear how woofy it sounds and it doesn't sound pristine and you can't hear a certain frequency. Okay, you got to fix that, because that's going to come out in the mix somehow and it's not going to be a good thing, you know? So that's really fun for me to be a teacher as well.
Yeah. And I've noticed that you've always been the type to really acknowledge your collaborators and shine a light on those, which is, again, that it's not, not all composers do that. We live in an era where there's a kind of, people enjoy this kind of mystique to the idea of the lone wolf, mad scientist genius. And the reality is, especially on a project of the scope of a Call of Duty, it takes a village. And the composer's job is simultaneously to write the music, but also to kind of captain the ship. And that there's an enormous amount of work that goes in, even just in the captaining part. And so a lot of folks kind of sweep to the side. They want to make it look like I did everything. And I think there's a kind of insecurity that drives that. And you've never been that way. I always see you tagging people online of, you know, I got a lot of people to thank for this one. And like I saw in the case of Black Ops Cold War particular, you know, the whole story of with Ayana and putting together this COVID choir singing is like apparently basically the most super spreader thing that you could possibly do.
It's so sad, right? It's so like, I just wanted to do something. And it was like, I literally was in the beginning of this thing. I was like, do I need choir, you know? And then it became when they finally named, because they didn't name this Cold War until pretty far into production, right? I didn't know that was the name. Once they named it Cold War, I was like, okay, got to have choir now. and I'm going to find a way to do a choir, even though I can't right now. We're going to figure it out. We're going to record individual voices, whatever. And we did.
That's actually pretty late. I'm actually surprised here because – when did you first start on the game?
Yeah, I think it was like April or something.
Exactly. I mean, I would have thought you started on the game, you know, a year ago or more.
Oh, no, we started – I got the phone call in November of 2019, but we didn't really start work until February, and then I didn't know what it was called until April, and then we recorded in June, and then we recorded again at end of August for the final stuff. But, like, I didn't even have a main theme written until, you know, a few weeks before the August session, or September session it was, really.
So this one really funneled through relatively tightly.
Yeah, because like I said, Sledgehammer was out and Chark was suddenly had to pick up the mantle and make it work, you know. So right. We were all scrambling a bit, and they didn't have the full thing mapped out yet. And so that happened, you know, over time, and it all worked out great.
How much music did you write then, over what span of time?
We did, let's see, about two and a half hours exactly.
Over and when in from like what was the actual
February sort of, through September? Yeah,
I mean, okay. That's actually pretty manageable. That's not too totally. Fast, but totally it also means that you're not taking a lot of days off in there. But it was
the pace was perfect. It was like every day was a joy because I wasn't stressed. Like but I was writing. I was productive. You know. And that to me is a lot of time. I've worked in television, done a number of TV shows. And you were talking just about a really interesting topic, and that is giving credit to those people who help you get it done. You know, a lot of people do think that composers work all on their own. And a lot of the time we are, let's face it. But when it comes to collaboration, like, this isn't something that comes naturally to people. I think it's tough because you do want to make your mark and you do want people to think of you and not somebody else because they did something with you. But over time, like I've, you know, maybe it's maybe it's my age or my experience, I don't know. But like over time, I have come to value collaboration so much, because not only does it always come out better in my view, but I learn things from that composer. Even if they're like, you know, really junior to me and have very little experience, I always learn something from people. Like, how'd you do that? Absolutely. Oh, that's cool. Oh, that's really cool. And then I can take that with me. And I value that. And, you know, I just, you know, and then when it comes to like doing multiplayer sets for the game, I always hire, a number of people, because I don't want it to sound all like me. I want the multiplayer sets to sound varied and interesting and different. So I hire really people I consider to be really talented. For example, in Black Ops Cold War for the multiplayer sets, we did five. I wrote two of them, and then I had Daniel James do a couple, and then great. He's the guy who, in case you don't know, is people in your audience don't know, he's the Hybrid 2 guy. He does Project Alpha, Beta, and Chaos, which Chaos was such a great tool that I use all the time, especially on Black Ops. But so Daniel James came in and did a couple, and then Or Kribos, who's now in Israel. He used to be in Oklahoma or something, went to school there. But I met him at a GDC one day, handed me like a flash drive of his stuff. And his stuff is so good. I mean, so talk about a great producer, like electronic music producer. He's so great.
The funny story about him, I saw him. I was meaning to ask you, and I'm thrilled to hear that connection, because I first met him as part of the Gang Scholars Program.
Yeah, I probably met him that year too.
Yeah, that explains it. For those who are not familiar with Gang, the Game Audio Network Guild, they do a thing at GDC where, you know, if it's your first ever GDC as a composer, you can apply to get a free all-access pass, and they'll pair you with someone who's been in the business for a little while to just kind of let you pick their brain. And one day I get, you know, I've mentored been the brain to be picked on that a bunch of times. And one year it was this guy, Oren, and he was like, you know, really, really, he showed up so ready to learn. He showed up like, he had thought about it in advance. He didn't take a second for granted. And he is to date the only one who, he goes, "Do you mind if I ask your address?" And I was like, fine. Gave him the address of my studio. And then like 3 weeks or something after GDC, a gift of a book that mattered to him shows up in the mail just as a thank you for doing that.
I know he's very thoughtful.
It's the only one who's ever done that. And to me, he stood out. It was like, that's a guy I want to see succeed. That's someone who.
Yeah, he same for me. Like, he sent me something at the end of this too. And he's just a great guy. He really is.
I love that.
That's important, right? Because you remember that.
Well, exactly. And I think before you ever have that feeling, I do understand the temptation to want to try to make it sound like, oh yeah, no, I did everything. You should definitely never look anywhere else for anybody. Mm-hmm. Like I get it. It's all born of insecurity though. But I think
it really
is.
It really is. Yeah.
But where you're coming from is this far more kind of inspiring perspective of I want to help usher the best possible music out into the world. And there are some genuinely talented people, and the world is better, and this game is better with their contribution. And I take a certain pride in being the guy that said, hey, you know who could really bring something to this? It's that person. And like, mm-hmm. Now you're a different kind of hero, you know? And it's not that you're sloughing off your own musical contributions in the process or somehow devaluing yourself. And to me, it's just an all around better thing to sort of signal boost those folks and make room for them all in one fell swoop.
Well, I was really inspired by two people in that regard. And that was Trevor Morris, who gave me my start in television, you know, far into my career. I mean, I started working with Trevor in 2013.
I was going to say, I'll never forget you and I sitting down opposite each other at a dinner table at some event. And it had been a little while since whatever previous thing had come out, maybe Mass Effect 2 or something. But I was like, hey, what have you been up to? And you really surprised me when you said, actually, I've been jamming on TV. And I was like, really? And yeah, no idea. I've only since then come to get to know Trevor, who's a real good guy. But yeah, that was a whole other, you've done a lot of work there since then.
It seemed like I've done over 120 episodes of TV. So that, you know, it's a lot of work, for somebody who just started, you know, 7 years ago. I haven't done any lately, unfortunately, but cause I miss it. I really enjoy television as well as
a totally different headspace.
Yeah. Yeah. You gotta, it's a whole different skill set really. But you know, that whole thing is, you know, so he was one guy and he was so generous with his credit and, you know, what we call in the business cue sheet, very important. Very generous with that. He's one of my best friends and just a great guy. And then Bear McCreary, you know, he once told me, cause I was talking to him at one point about, you know, at any given time, he'll have like 5 to 10 shows, right? It's like, there's no way he's writing all that. So I just said to him, you know, how do you manage all that? And he said, you know, I have to think of myself as the creative director of an enterprise, you know, and that was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Cause they're hiring you no matter what, and you're the one who has to make it happen. And they just know that you can deliver that. So, and I get the same feeling from Treyarch. They don't care who I hire, you know, to help out. As long as I'm the guy doing it who they trust can deliver it, you know?
Yeah. You're still the producer. You're still having to bless the mixes, the writing, the choices. Yeah,
and I do. And I probably am even more scrutinizing when another composer is writing for the game, because I know that it's got to sound like me. It's got to sound like it came from the same game. Right.
Yeah, of course.
Or it's, you know, it's like when I work with Jimmy Henson on stuff, like he and I have co-written all the MP3 multiplayer themes that play in the menu for all the multiplayers for the last 4 games. And or actually, we didn't do one of them. We did two, 4, and Cold War. And, you know, it's just so fun to work with him because he's just a great electronic guy. Yeah. And then, but it's a real collaboration because, you know, I get in there, we pass the files back and forth like 4 or 5 times, you know, and then I do the final mix. So it's just really, that's a really,
he's such
thing.
A good dude. He's such a, I really
such
like
a
him.
Great guy. Yeah. You know, it's funny, you and I've been talking about, you know, as much as we love talent, it's really important to be somebody who's personable and that you like, right?
Oh yeah,
that's like just as important, really. So,
yeah, you could even argue it's more important because if somebody like if Jimmy, we'll use him as an example. If Jimmy threw something over the fence, and for whatever reason, maybe he was having an off day, it just wasn't quite there. Your first reaction isn't going to be, you know, dude, we got a job to do here. What the fuck is wrong? And just like go into this attack mode because your starting position is, I like this guy. I hope everything's okay. Is everything like, I want to have his back. He's got mine. Let's make this about the camaraderie of getting through this together. If something's going on with him and maybe I need to pick up the slack, like, okay, we'll find a way to do that. It's not like, you know, like there's some, it's not a cash register thing. You know, if you go to a hardware store and you go to buy something and the person is just like super rude or disrespectful, like you have to be a pretty profoundly empathetic person to say, you know, how are you? Are you doing okay? Like, and the best among us would do that, but it's not ununderstandable to feel like, look, you have one job. I'm not asking a lot here. And yet, in a musical collaboration, it's never felt like that to me. It's, you know, like if my orchestrator is suddenly like falling behind on charts and the copyist is sitting on their hands, you know, I know something's going on and I want to make sure that she's good and that like she's in a healthy headspace. I'm never going to suddenly freak out about, holy shit, that we're behind on the charts. Like, you know,
Right. Right.
We'll solve these things in the order that they matter.
Right.
I think that, yeah, that comes from just realizing that it's back to your Brian Toohey story. It's the relationships. It's also
that people are making these things, not robots, you know. It's like,
yeah,
they may have other stuff going on. And you run into that a lot, more than you would think. It's like, oh, something's happening. I need to check in and make sure somebody's okay. And yeah, that happens a lot, actually.
Yeah, and it really matters because, you know, the goal for me is always I want this to be just another checkpoint in the road with this person, you know, especially with a core team member, someone you collaborate with a bunch. At least for me, that's ideally, you know, you're teeing up a 10, 20, 30, 40 year relationship. And you know, you would have to therefore treat that the way you would treat any other long-term relationship. I think, I mean, it's not that different from marriage or like a lifelong best friend or something, where it has to be born from genuinely mutually caring about each other and not just, hey, can you deliver this? Yes or no.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And they are long relationships. I've worked with people, you know, Ross and Audrey de Roche, they are my music coordinators, and, you know, they handle so much stuff for me that is, you know, having to do with recording, you know. And it's just such a wonderful thing to have, you know, I could just go to, I've been working with them for 20 years.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah,
we started on Mystery together in 1999. So
it's so easy to, I think, because especially a lot of the game industry is a little bit more corporate in its structure, where, you know, you hold your job on the basis of, are you delivering? And you hold your job on the basis of like, is the company healthy enough that it's, you know, we're able to meet our financial projections in order to maintain your salary, et cetera, et cetera. There, a lot of it does come down to a little bit of just like the cold hard numbers. And in our world where everything's freelance and these teams are put together in a way ad hoc every time, the relationship is what is informing all of that first and foremost. And so, yeah, it's really about the people. Like, I've lost money on jobs in order to hire my team, you know, like my mixer, my engineer, those people where I'm like, I want the product to be good and I'm going to take a bath, but this isn't going to be our last rodeo. You know, as a more corporate entity, you know, it's harder, especially God, if you're like a publicly traded company, you're not really in a position to make those kinds of calls, at least so easily.
Yeah.
I want to circle back.
What we do.
Yeah, exactly. I want to circle over to Mass Effect briefly because I just can't gloss over it. It's just the best thing. I just love it. But I also feel like there's a real, you know, even though I know it's not a happy story. Like you said, you felt heartbroken. You said about not being involved in the third one. You made such a massive stamp on the first two. And to me, it's one of the most, you know, who'd have guessed that BioWare coming out with this new IP kind of seemingly out of nowhere would create truly one of the iconic celebrated franchises of all time, with some of the most memorable characters and moments. I mean, to me, it is truly one of my most cherished gaming experiences I've ever had. It's one of the only times I can remember credits start to roll and I thought, I've just played one of my lifelong, like, this will be one of my lifelong favorite games. And usually it takes the marination and the passage of time to realize, oh, wow, that's really stuck with me. But this was one that just, when the first game ended, and I just thought, oh, my God. And I was a late adopter to it, too. So where did this, just kind of give me the rundown on where did this come into your life? This is not a Brian Toohey project. So this was, did you demo like anybody else, or come into this, because I don't think there's a prior relationship with anyone at BioWare unless I just don't know about it, right?
There was, actually.
There
I think
you
it was
go.
2005, maybe, or 2000, had to be 2004, maybe. Not sure. Do you remember Dave Chan? Do you know Dave Chan?
Yeah, Dave Chan
was working at BioWare as one of the lead sound designers. And he just pulled me aside at GDC one day and said, hey, would you be interested in in maybe working on one of our games? And I was like, yes. And that turned out to be Jade Empire. I think I had to audition and won the audition, and did sort of the quasi East meets West Chinese score for that. And that went really well. And then they asked me, they had this new game coming up in 2006. They asked me to audition for called SFX was the code name for it. And that ended up being Mass Effect. And I auditioned for that and won that audition. So
how did that go in terms of, because I know that didn't you and Sam end up, Sam Hulick, didn't you guys kind of trade material back and forth a bit on that? Because there's some cues that really feel like it's this real marriage of the two of you. Because for the most part, there's a few different composers on Mass Effect, on all of the games. There's a handful.
Yeah, that's where I started all the collaboration. You know, out of necessity, I was going through some personal difficulties at the time. And I remember I was trying to write, the main theme. And well, before I even get to that point, the first meeting I had with Casey and Shauna Perry and all the people at BioWare, they had me come up to Edmonton, flew me up there, and there's like this hotel that is adjacent to their offices, so I would stay there. I met with them for the first time, and they were like, we were talking about music, and Casey Hudson was explaining his ideas, you know, about this sort of Tangerine Dream, Blade Runner kind of idea. You know, let's go back in time to the 80s and do some synth work.
And it's really worth highlighting that because that has become, you know, so ubiquitous. But at the time, especially for something going
through. There was nowhere. No one was doing that. Yeah.
No one was doing it, especially on a blockbuster, like this is a game with big ambitions kind of level, you know, maybe
and again, this was one of those times where I said, can you do synth work from the 80s? I'm like, yep, I have no idea what the hell I'm doing, but I'm going to do it, you know? And I remember Casey said, well, there was one piece of music that, you know, we all really liked from like a demo perspective that I'd like to play for you now. And he played Uncharted Worlds, and that wasn't called that then, but that was Sam's piece that he demoed when he was auditioning, right? And I heard it, and right at the end of it, I was just like, this is probably the stupidest thing in the world to say, but I was so dumbfounded by how good that piece of music was that I said, like, why did you hire me? Like, that is awesome.
I had no idea that piece was
a demo.
Yeah. I had no idea.
Yeah. That's still amazing. One of my favorite pieces from the entire series.
Oh, so. And it's people love that.
Yeah, and it's just it was a Arturia patch, you know, that he kind of messed with, and it came out great. And it's almost like you can't even decipher what it is, but it sounds just so right.
And it's really married to the identity of Mass Effect at this point as well.
Yeah, it totally is. So, you know, I was having some personal difficulties, which was pulling my focus. I had, you know, death in the family and some stuff going on. And, you know, it was like I was trying to write this main theme. And I must have done 6 or 7, you know, passes at it. And then, you know, at some point I just said, you know, maybe we can – I can bring in Sam and he can help me do this. So Sam came in and he started writing 30-second snippets of stuff that ended up becoming the main theme for Mass Effect. And then I started working with him and we collaborated on that a little bit. And I did the mix and added some stuff and just tried to make it a little bit. Because Sam didn't have a lot of experience with orchestra and stuff at that point.
Right, sure.
He was kind of a real newbie, and that's why they didn't hire him, because they just didn't know if he could actually handle it. But, you know, we just kept him on and he kept working on the game, and he wrote several themes. We never worked together except for the main theme, but he wrote a few really important themes for that game, so much so that, like, I was like, let's just have Sam be a co-composer, because that's only fair to him, you know. Because he helped write the main theme, he you know he he came up with that. He wrote Sovereign's theme, which is really important, a few other things. And so that's how Sam came in. And then I had like, I think it was Jimmy Hinson wrote a few pieces with us. And then David Cates wrote a few pieces with us, I think. And unless I'm confusing that with the next game, Mass Effect 2. But
I remember Richard Jakes also made an appearance in there.
Oh, that's what I'm talking about. Richard Jakes. Richard Jakes wrote. So it was Richard, David, and Jimmy sort of helped flush out. Because at the end, you know, like we had 50 minutes of music to write in like 2 weeks. It was like that. Because all the cinematics came in at the end. So it was like, so basically I was the, you know, I was sort of the lead on all that and I would divvy out the work. And so Richard wrote like the Citadel piece, where you come up to the Citadel first, and it was an amalgamation of themes that Sam and I had written. And he just took those themes and crafted this beautiful piece of music, which was Richard's.
It was really surprising to me, actually, when I dug into it after having, because I never listened to the music or knew anything about it until after I played it and went digging. And I was actually really surprised to see so many names, because it really all felt surprisingly cohesive.
And that's where, like, you know, I had arguments with Sam at the end where I brought in the writer was sort of like, Sam was trying to write a new piece of music for the ending. And I said, we can't do that. And they were like, why not? But I really like this piece. I said, yeah, it's a great piece of music, but it has nothing to do with the rest of the score. I was like, you know, now's the time to bring back a theme right now. This is the time when we bring back Sovereign's theme or whatever I said. And it's got to be this piece of music. So, you know, and I was having this argument with Mac Walters, who was the head writer, and Sam, because Mac really liked what Sam had done. And I said, I don't think this is the right thing. And so Casey came in to that conversation, and Casey said, no, Jack's right. It's got to be, we have to reprise one of the themes or the main theme or something. So I can't remember what piece that was, but yeah. And I think Sam ended up using that in a later version of Mass Effect. So it all worked out. But yeah, it's just one of those things where somebody has to have the vision for the score. It can't just be this. See, I felt... you know, that all the music written for Mass Effect 3 was really well produced. I thought better produced than I was doing, frankly. It all sounded really great. But it didn't have like, it felt like almost like you would put a bunch of licensed tunes into it, you know, because it didn't have like a through line. There wasn't like, people weren't guided to, okay, use this theme for this and use that theme for this. But, you know, it was sort of just like everyone's writing these great pieces of music, but there was no cohesiveness to it because there was like six composers on it. And, it, you know, I don't mean to sound like sour grapes at all. That's not why I'm saying that. When I look at it from the 30,000 foot view, that's how I felt when I played that game. Because they would use my music like in weird places. And it was just like, why would you use my – the most important moment of the entire series is when – the Reapers come, right? And that's the moment you've been building up to for the entire series, right? Mm-hmm. And the Normandy shows up and you play the Normandy theme and it's like, that's way too triumphant for this moment. You know, it's like that kind of stuff.
You could feel that it became a little bit splintered musically in the third one. And I think your assessment is spot on, even though you have every right to not be objective, piece is really, there's a lot of really wonderful, very masterful writing and production. But it really is a great little bit of a
I mean, Chris Leonard's and yeah, all those guys. Yeah. Great.
Yeah. Yeah. Mansell. Yeah. It's really, it was a touch all over the place compared to how surprisingly tight the first two had been. And so just,
yeah. And one of the things that I sort of insisted on, maybe to my detriment in the end, but when we did Mass Effect 2, I said, you know, I have to be the lead composer because I don't want to, you know, I want to make sure that we have a cohesive experience in Mass Effect 2. It has to be, you know, we did a whole, you know, post-mortem on Mass Effect 1, and as great as that experience was, it was tough because it was, you know, we were bringing another composer into it, and we did have some friction at the end of that. But, and I'm not used to friction. I don't like friction. I like things to go very smoothly. And I just felt like the reason it didn't go smoothly is because I dropped the ball. You know, I did drop the ball, and I had some personal stuff going on. I let get in the way. And, you know, I'm not innocent in, you know, in all that. I am not, you know, flawless at all. I don't mean to suggest that, but it is, it's just one of those things where you, you know, you want there to be, you know, a sort of cohesive experience as a composer. At least I do, you know.
I couldn't agree more. And I've been there as well, where personal stuff really interfered with the ability to deliver, and it cost me. So I totally get that. And say again.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's just like it's an unfortunate thing that it still haunts me, because it was such in a lot of ways it was such a great experience to write for that game. I mean, it's one of the most memorable games out there. I'm so proud of my work on it. I'm so proud to be a small part of it. And all that, but I just feel like it was also one of the hardest experiences, especially not getting invited back. And yeah, it's tough, man. You know, it's not all some one person's fault. I have plenty of culpability in that. And I'm not ashamed to say that, because
life is hard. You know, that's kind of what I was getting at with the work-life balance question of, you know, it's not so easy of just keeping things in nice, neat little bubbles, because it's our life, our, you know, like, Jack Wall goes through day-to-day life and spends some of that portion of the day writing music and taking meetings and doing all this, masterminding the next thing, and then dealing with everything else in life. It's like, it's all funneling through the same brain. The idea that something personal would not somehow influence the work that you're doing is naive. It's knowing that is hardly a comfort. It's really challenging to suss those out, especially when it's a thing where, you know, there's like tens of millions of dollars on the line, and you're a not small part of the apparatus that's been built to make that all come off successfully.
That's true. Yep. Yeah. And back then, back in 2007 or whatever it was, 2006, when we were making Mass Effect, the first one, and we brought Sam on, that I was back in the mindset of but it has to be all me, you know? And so over my career, I've let go of all that, you know? And that was the beginning of it, where Sam came in, and then I had to say, you know, he deserves credit. I can't not credit him. I'd be a jerk if I didn't do that. Right. So, I don't even remember if it was up to me or not, but I just felt like, you know, that was the beginning of me letting go a little bit and understanding what the true nature of our job is. And that is, you're more of a creative director. Like Bear McCreary says, you're responsible for the overall product. Somebody is directly responsible for all of it. And that was a good lesson for me. Being forced to let go a little bit. It's hard, especially when you're young at this and doing it, you know, this is my big break, you know. But
And there's also the control freak element of like I'm still very much a work in progress in this way, but in my own sort of analogous moments, I've had, you know, I've felt that shift over time of, if I ask someone, hey, can you help me with this little thing here? And they come back with it. And I'm like, well, that's not really how I would have done it. And it's like, well, yeah, obviously that's baked into the premise of this situation. You're not doing it. And so at some point it becomes, okay, how do I look for the things to celebrate in what the person did? And if there's problems with it, if there's things I genuinely disagree with, that's one thing. But just by virtue of it not being me does not somehow knock it down a point as if I'm the default state of musical perfection and everything therefore is just inherently lesser. It's like you have to get over the insecurity and really look at that and say, oh wow, that's so cool, I wouldn't have written that, you know. And
that's right, that's the whole point right there.
It can be hard. Yeah, it can be a challenge.
I've definitely learned to embrace the differences. I mean, you know, you, like you said, you do have to keep it on point for what, you know, what makes it still work in the score. Are there the right fragments of melody or whatever, leitmotif is in there, just sort of nodded to maybe. And then it's really cool. Like, I love it. Like, to be honest with you, I love it when somebody takes my melody and does their own thing with it, but it's still my melody. It's a little bit selfish, but it's just really cool to see what somebody else would do with that.
Yeah. They reveal things that you yourself would have been blind to.
Yeah. Well, it also, in a way, it almost legitimizes your melody too, because somebody else took it and did something with it. Yeah. You know, it's like, oh, I guess that is a good melody because I'm hearing it totally differently and I can hear that it's good, you know. So far into it, you don't even know anymore. But
you've been real generous with your time, but I have one, there's one last thing that it would be absolutely insane to gloss over. I moved to Los Angeles in 2005. And one of the very first experiences I had upon moving here was Video Games Live at the Hollywood Bowl. And subsequently saw you conduct that show many times. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, what you and Tommy created there is really unlike anything else. And for someone who's, you know, been living in the studio and writing piles of great music, to have helped create this public, like this way for people to celebrate this music. I mean, talk about propping up colleagues too. I mean, how many zillions of other composers' pieces have you conducted at this point?
Yeah,
but it's been a number of years. I know that you hung up that hat a while ago. But it just needs acknowledgement that being part of Video Games Live and helping, you know, from the beginning, that and big giant TV special and all the rest of it. I mean, that was such a powerful force in helping to legitimize the art to the outside world, who basically just thought, oh, it's just like those sounds coming out of a Game Boy, I assume. You know, that's what video game music is.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The whole thing, and especially in 2005 when we were starting, was like, why would anybody want to hear bleeps and bloops played by an orchestra? Yeah, it was that was the tough thing. You know, it's that's a perfect example of, like, you know, never saying no. Like, you know, it's just like, hey, we have this idea, let's see if we can do something with it. And then just pitching it to a few people, and then you get some attorney who says, oh, this guy at William Morris might be interested in this. And we pitched it to him, and Tommy's a great pitcher. You know, I'm going to give him all the credit for that. And then, you know, the agent at William Morris saying, yeah, we're going to make this happen. Let's do a deal with Clear Channel, which then became Live Nation. And they gave it back to us because they had to spin it off into Live Nation. So they put $2 million into the formation of that show, and then they gave it back to us. So
that's lucky.
It was just a lot of luck and a lot of just right place, the right time. That Tommy and I just took it and ran with it ourselves, learned how to do it, learned how to be performers, learned how to, you know, put a show together, learned how to produce a big show. I mean, you know, we did huge shows, and then we worked with big television producers for PBS and did that thing. And oh, Jesus, it was really, really a lot of fun. I think I did 155 shows as a conductor.
That's what I was going to ask.
About 60 different orchestras around the world, and wonderful. And I did it for 5 years and quit in 2010 to get back to composing, because I was kind of losing the thread there. And Tommy's kept this going for another 10 years, twice as long as when I was with it. So kudos to him for making that happen. But it was a great experience. I learned a lot. I remember conducting, I think it was my third show conducting, where I was a fairly new conductor. You know, I hadn't done a lot of conducting live, especially. And I remember being in Houston with the Houston Symphony, huge symphony. I mean, we had, like, I don't know, 90 people in the symphony and there was like 70 people in the choir. And I remember walking out in rehearsal and just being completely overwhelmed. Like, oh my God, I have to control 160 people right now musically. And I remember thinking, you know, act like you know, just act like you know what you're doing, dude, because you have never done this before. And it all went off. And I remember going back to Cindy was not at that show. She was home. And I called her up and I started crying. I was like, I don't know why I'm here. I shouldn't be here. This is way over my head. But, you know, I pulled it off and I was never that scared again. So you gotta push yourself. My pearl of wisdom there.
And it's such a recurring theme of your career and most of our careers at some level or another that we, if you put yourself in the position where you have to solve it creatively, you have to rely on yourself or maybe, you know, reaching out to friends or whomever. But if you put yourself in the position, you know, that fight or flight instinct, you'll figure it out. You know, if the other choice is catastrophic failure and destruction, you're probably not going to go that route. You're probably going to solve it. And it's, yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of people, I get so many emails saying, how do I know when I'm ready? And I'm like, you will learn that you were ready when you're looking back on it and say, I guess it turns out I was ready. At no point will you feel that in advance about anything.
No, and you should, and hopefully you will never feel that in advance because that's part of that's part of the fun of it. I mean, you know, I'm craving something. What haven't I done that I never thought I could do? Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm looking for now. Like, what can I do that's even bigger, you know?
Well, I look forward to your speed metal album.
That probably won't happen, but I'll leave that to the experts. But
we'll see. Well, man, I really appreciate you doing this.
Dude, you're such a good interviewer, and it's such a pleasure, man. I love your style of interview. This conversational style is so welcome. I love it.
Well, I really don't think of it as an interview. I think of it, you know, when our friends at DICE asked me if I'd be interested in doing this, it was like, so wait a minute. I get to sit down with people I really like and am friends with and have huge amounts of admiration for and consider myself a genuine fan of, and we get to actually just talk some shop. Like, you know, how horrible, what a flawed premise. It's a privilege to be able to do this and to sit in this chair, even if it's right now just the chair in my studio instead of some, you know, like the very first one of these was with Jason Graves in a hotel room in San Francisco during GDC.
Nice.
That's cool. That to me was what this normally was. And then only recently have we switched to the remote COVID version, but it is, it's a privilege.
Yeah, well,
man.
I look forward to when we can be in the same room again, brother. It's going to be way too long when that happens. But I think you and Emily Reese are probably the best people to have a conversation with. Yeah, I mean, she's great too. You guys are like the Terry Gross of game music, you know.
Funny. Well, I appreciate it, man. It is it's a pleasure and a joy. And enjoy London. You're off to, I guess, Portugal.
Yeah, next? We're gonna go spend a couple months there and check it out and see what's what. I mean,
did you take any kind of mobile rig with you, or are you just taking a break?
You know, I didn't, but I might have to put one together because I got some music coming up in January and I don't think I'll be home yet. So I may have to quickly figure that out. I do have my laptop, so it shouldn't be too hard.
Quite the bohemian.
I'll get my assistant to ship me out a drive or something.
I love
it. See how that goes. Yeah. Cool.
All right, man. Well, enjoy it. Give my best to Cindy, and we'll talk soon.
I will do. Thank you, brother. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.